Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the first day of February. All things political this hour, and John Zogby is our guest, pollster, president, and CEO of Zogby International, a worldwide research and marketing firm. He says that he believes an online polling methodology is where the future of polling is headed, as more than 90% of likely voters nationwide say they regularly log on to the internet to check email or also to get their news. For the 2008 election season, he teamed up with Reuters and C-SPAN, and he provided political survey research on the race for the White House. Since 1996, he has polled for Reuters, and he's also polled earlier for NBC News. His clients include MSNBC, CNBC, The New York Post, Fox News, Knight Ridder Newspapers, Gannett News Service, The Houston Chronicle, Miami Herald, Atlanta Constitution, the Albany Times Union, and the list goes on. It would take a long time to say all of it. He writes a weekly column for Forbes.com, a monthly column for Politics Magazine. He writes extensively for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Christian Science Monitor, Philadelphia Inquirer, Newsday, and the Boston Globe, and is a founding contributor to the website The Huffington Post. He is a senior advisor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he's the author of The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, which was published by Random House in August of 2008. We'll be welcoming phone calls for John Zogby. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We always like to hear from you. You can send an email as well, and that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, John Zogby.
Hi, Kathleen. Glad to be back again.
Yeah, great to have you here. All right, the State of the Union speech. Let's start with that. You say it was a good blend of creative populism and that he got back on track with that speech. Tell me more.
Yeah, clearly the president was off track. If you measure him just by his own standards, he was to be the game changer. He was going to change not only the debate in Washington, but how things got debated in Washington. And clearly, he has failed in doing that, and frankly, everyone has failed in doing that. Washington's as hyper-partisan today as it ever was. And I think what he was able to do as president of the United States, with over 40 million, nearly 50 million people watching, was to change the tone and get back to the Barack Obama that was elected 15 months ago, and to talk in terms of touching all bases, of talking to his progressive base and asking them to be patient and giving and compromising, but also to say to Republicans, I'm willing to listen to you, I'm still willing to listen to you, and quite frankly, you Republicans are doing well today, but don't expect to do well in November if you're just the party of no. We were all elected to get something done. I think it was the right tone, and I think this is a man of unique skill.
Mm-hmm. And yet he seems to be counting on swaying some of those Republicans. I was struck, John, by your poll that showed that before the State of the Union, he had approval ratings. Are you proud to have him as your president, was the question. 88% of Democrats, yay. Only 11% of Republicans.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
And frankly, that's not a new question. We've been asking that since the Clinton days. And there's always been, you know, obviously a tremendous level of partisanship on that question. But this is about as dramatic as we've ever seen. This is about as bad for a president in terms of hyper-partisanship as we've ever seen. And I think it's a good measure. I mean, that's quite an extreme, proud or ashamed. No colors in between. I think it reveals an awful lot about the state of public opinion outside the Beltway as well.
So tell me why this kind of hyper-partisanship?
Well, I think for starters, you know, it's the sort of thing that we've been experiencing over the past three decades. And I think that it's been exacerbated, obviously, by what we used to call new media. They're now older media, cable television and hyper-partisan talk radio and so on. But I think it's also aggravated by an obsolete process inside the Beltway, where on one hand it takes one thing to in your district for a congressman or woman to get elected, very personal and intimate sort of relationship with the voters. On the other hand, it takes partisanship in order to succeed in Congress, in order to be effective, in order to be able to go to the voters and be reelected. And the fact that so many districts in this country have become intensely partisan districts means that for many safe Republicans and safe Democrats, it's just not in their interest to behave any other way except to appeal to their base.
Mm-hmm.
That's one part of it. The other part of it is that there's been no national message that has emerged. You know, we had a triumph of liberalism in the 60s and 70s, a triumph then of conservatism in the 80s and 90s. And now I think we're at a point where liberalism as a big government ideology is bankrupt, conservatism as a free market ideology and socially intrusive ideology is bankrupt. And so the next step is to offer, as in varying degrees, each of the last three presidents have tried to offer, even to some degree George W. Bush, a third way. But I think it kind of shows where there's a disconnect between a public who's saying, yeah, we'll take a third way, but a system in Washington that says, yeah, but this isn't how we're structured.
Mm-hmm. What good does it do the president to go have this rather extraordinary encounter with congressional Republicans that is televised? He's trying to take on this partisan issue, but it just doesn't seem to get him anywhere. First, it's Olympia Snow. She doesn't help out on health care. Now it's having this Q&A with Republicans in Congress. Is he trying to tell the American people, listen, I'm really a guy who doesn't have an ideology. I'm trying to make bipartisanship work. Does that help him in the long run, and does it sway any Republicans?
Well, you know, first of all, let's back up. He is the president of the United States, and this is a power that a president has that's not written in the Constitution. He's the only one that can command the network's interest, the only one that can talk directly to tens of millions of Americans. And the way the camera was set up, it was set up on him.
Right.
It wasn't set up on individual members. Powerful reminder that he's the guy in charge. Without tipping a partisan hat here at all, to be really as objective as I can, I thought it was a stroke of brilliance. He was going right into the belly of the beast and not backing down. It wasn't a public humiliation or a public apology. What he did was he got to say what was on his mind and to remind Republicans that, hey, you know, when you go for to be elected and reelected in November, don't think you're going to get you're going to win control of both houses of Congress because you held up a stop sign. I mean, essentially, there are plenty of voters in this country who are saying, "What have you done?" You know, those are Samuel Popkin's famous questions: "What have you done for me lately?" and "What are you going to do for me?" And that's still a Republican problem.
Mm-hmm.
What have they done for me lately? Ooh, okay, that's a very short list. What will you do for me next? Well, we don't see a Republican agenda except to say no.
Right. You of all people, and I'm so glad you're with us, can answer this for me. We've done series of programs on health care reform. I need a sense of, maybe if I'm wrong, let me know, but I have this sense that last summer when polled, people said they really wanted some kind of public option in the health care reform. And now, inexplicably, we find ourselves at a time when everybody's saying, no, we don't want health care reform. Scott Brown said he didn't want it. That's why he got elected. We're not on the same page you are on this. Where are we on this issue right now?
You know, it's very complicated. But the bottom line is I've done an enormous amount of polling on this question. And yes, the voters want the public option, but they've lost, the Democrats have lost the language on it. If they just called it universal, or if they called it a government backup to ensure universality and to and competition against the insurance companies. They win on it. Voters also told us they wanted tort reform and cost control. Voters told us, in essence, that there was a coming together, that there were elements of what conservatives stand for that they wanted, elements of what liberals stand for that they wanted, and that that was their ideal type bill. From there, though, what happened during the summer is that Augusts are cruel to Democrats. Democrats can't go on vacation, and the president went on vacation again in August, and it was at that time that Republicans are geniuses at creating values-based bumper stickers. Death panel.
Mm.
Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Big government. Those are hard to contend with. I wrote a piece in Forbes, Hearts Beats Charts, it was entitled, and it was the same message that I used when I spoke to the Senate Democratic Caucus a couple of years ago, when they were telling me, oh, we're going to go out and win these elections because we're going to show how much the war in Iraq is costing each family, and we're going to show how American people are getting ripped off dollar by dollar. And I was saying, you've got to be able to say it in a bumper sticker and a graphic. You've got to appeal to the heart and not present charts. And I don't think Democrats get that yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to what I thought was a really interesting column in the Times yesterday, the muddled selling of the president, in which the author talked a great deal about the fact that the Obama story is, and this whole administration and the problems of the country, let me quote, no longer so simple or easy to tell. A strong, clear narrative helps a president connect with voters and explain the journey he's leading. The lack of one invites opponents to craft a less flattering portrayal. And yet we do have a president who eludes simple labels.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, it is true. Also, that can be turned into his favor. He's the first president of the next America. He's a first global citizen. He is one of a growing number of Americans, particularly younger Americans, who's multi-ethnic, multi-continental, multi-focused in terms of problems, geography, you know, so many things. This is kind of a turning point in American history that he represents. You know, when we ask young people, and this is almost 4 years ago, which makes it very significant, when we ask young people, what will America look like 20 years from now? Well, in 2005, the number one open-ended response by young people was Barack Obama.
Huh.
Wait, why? Because he's like us. He looks just like us. So in that sense, there is a narrative. But then it gets a little complicated. When enemies are allowed or opponents are allowed to write the narrative and to write it in a negative or even a muddled way, it dredges up some very uncomfortable things. And frankly, Kathleen, I think race is a part of that.
Do you really?
I do. Not that I'll ever be able to measure it
right
adequately, but it's there. It's there.
Yeah. Do you think, John, I think most people would agree that this guy is exceptionally smart. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think he's got some kind of plan to get health care, to get jobs for the country, and he's just trying to figure out the best way to get what he wants. Do you think there's an element of truth in that he's figuring this strategy and then that strategy, and he's got some kind of plan that we're just not aware of? Or am I way off base?
Wow, what Martin Luther King would call redemptive suffering. I think most of us would opt for the redemption part of that only, don't you think? man, there's a lot of easier ways to do this. No, I don't think so. Obviously, he's very smart, and obviously, he knows how to stay on plan and focused. But let's also be very, honest about this. He was a 47-year-old man who had not run anything except successful campaigns. And I think arguably, this is easy to say 15 months later, he chose the wrong team. Frankly, with this getting back on message, I think it's time to bring George Mitchell and Lee Hamilton into this game, if they're willing. Much the way that Bill Clinton brought David Durkin in,
mm-hmm.
much the way that Ronald Reagan brought Howard Baker in after Iran-Contra. Somebody with some gravitas, with some gray hair. frankly, I would also put John Warner's name in there, too. You know, kind of that gray-haired, gentlemanly Republican who everybody respects. But that's, I think, what's needed right now, and essentially not Rahm Emanuel.
Mm.
With all respect to Rahm Emanuel, I don't think he's the man of the hour right now.
So you bring these guys in to do what?
Well, chief of staff.
Oh.
To guard the president, and also to set a new tone, and also to what Mitchell could do in Northern Ireland, and I'm sure eventually could do in the Middle East, I think he's got to be able to do with Democrats and Republicans, which is to get them now to actually sit down and find the elements of agreement. You can talk about, we've come to the stage where, will you listen to us? Will you find the elements of agreement? All right, find them. But now, hey, I run a business, and there are always all sorts of problems. Whenever I chair a meeting, I say, all right, let's operate under the assumption that we can resolve this. So let's not talk about all of the obstacles that we face. Let's cut right to the chase. Hmm. And I think that's what needs to be done here.
John Zogby is our guest for All Things Political, pollster, president, CEO of Zogby International, author of The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for John Zogby. Sarah from Eau Claire. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just had a couple of comments, and I just wanted to say that I am not impressed with the president's message about getting back on track, because I think that the only reason he did that was because of Scott Brown winning the election in Massachusetts, and I don't think that we would have seen him sitting there with Republicans having his conversation with them, trying to hear what their ideas and what they were upset about and what they wanted to change. I don't think that would have happened at all if that wouldn't have happened in Massachusetts. So I don't feel that I can trust him, and I don't think that it's a sincere thing, but other than he was cornered back against the wall, and he really had no choice. And as far as the comment about Scott Brown and him saying no to health care, he did not say no to health care. What he said was no to the way it was being done, which is what a lot of people are concerned about. I want a health care, universal health care for everyone, but I don't want it at the cost of our future children and it being, them being overburdened. And I think that the message was sent very clear.
Okay, let's get some response. John, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I know where Eau Claire is. I was just there.
Oh, really?
9 days ago. Yeah, lovely. Lovely area.
Isn't it pretty?
It really is. Love those trees. look, in terms of what the caller says, you can either be cynical, and I think a lot of Americans are cynical, or you can say the public has spoken, and do you want a leadership that gets the message or doesn't get the message? And I think that what Obama did was show that he got the message and that there's some flexibility there, and probably that here was maybe an opportunity for him to get on track again. Remember, these are the very messages of cooperation and listening to the other side, you know, that got him elected in the first place. Now, regarding health care, I think the caller is absolutely right. It health care reform was indeed a top priority of the American people. No one misread that at all. Even with the economy tanking, one of the number one sources of status anxiety in the country has been health insurance, lack of health insurance or unaffordable health insurance or health care. And so in that sense, there are a lot of people out there who do support health care reform, including a Republican version of it. I think the problem has been two sides just have not been talking to each other. And I think also that the American people, as the caller suggests, feel sort of sacrificed out. You know, when they start to hear trillions as a unit of measurement, you know, for stimulus, for banking and auto company bailouts, and then for health insurance reform, that, you know, there's a an understandable recoiling on that.
Right. So, and talk a little bit more about all of those big entities, the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, the banks, et cetera. How do you measure our outrage about their salaries and about their influence on government, John?
They are all oil companies today. Being from a profession that's kind of close to the bottom in terms of public respect, I can empathize with banks and insurance companies, pharmaceuticals get very, very low marks in terms of public respect these days. They're seen as behemoths. They're seen as selfish. Rightly or wrongly, they're seen as putting profits ahead of public service. Voters will tell us they like what they get from pharmaceuticals in terms of the product and in terms of the research, but still there's that bad boy image. Mm. And they're also seen, needless to say, as powerful and resistant to change, as are many institutions. So, frankly, are our teachers' unions, so are auto unions, so are a lot of our institutions today. Kathleen, in a broader picture here, as Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, would say, we are in a period of creative destruction right now, and we are witnessing the destruction first. And it appears, I want to put all this into context, that we're in a state of chaos, where so much of our familiar institutions that we've counted on in the past just don't seem to be working for us. And so we're experiencing those like all at once right now. We'll emerge from this better, but in the meantime, you know, let's tick them off: politics, government, ecclesiastical, educational, and so on. A corporate, they don't seem to be working the way that Americans are accustomed to having them work on their behalf.
Mm. Sarah, thanks very much for your comments from beautiful Eau Claire. Nicholas from Waukesha. Hi. Hi, Nicholas. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Nicholas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, first of all, I agree with a lot of what your intelligent guest has given us. I did not vote for Obama, but I would have if he would have been pro-life. Because people were generally, frustrated with the other party. But I did not vote for him. But, I was brought up in Catholic schools, and I was told that you should love the sinner and hate the sin. So I love Obama. I hate the sin of abortion and gay abuse. But I want to give him a suggestion. He looks so tired, so fatigued, so exhausted all the time, which is not good steed for him. You know, President Bush, though he had many weaknesses, yet he went to bed at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, and then he got up, and he was always energetic. But I would recommend that he start taking care of his health, stop spreading himself too thin, and also stop traveling so much, and get rid of his staff. I believe in your guest, and he said he should get rid of his staff.
Of Rahm Emanuel.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Do you think he's looking pretty tuckered, John?
Oh, I think it's taken a toll on him as much as it's taken a toll on every president. It's really remarkable when you see the aging photos of pretty much everyone who's been in the presidency. With, you know, I guess with the exception of Ronald Reagan, who managed to keep that very black hair for 8 years. I'm kind of kidding.
Yeah, I know. A few touch-ups here and there, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, the president is awfully thin. And, you know, that's a little worrisome right there. That you know, God bless him. There are those of us who strive to have that kind of physique and never achieve it. But he is awfully thin, and here and there he's lost 5, 6, or 10 pounds, and he really can't afford it. It really does show, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does look like he's been having a rough year.
It's an awful job.
Oh, can you imagine, John?
No.
Can you imagine? And yet when he was doing the basketball commentary this weekend, I thought he looked great. Yeah, he was having a good time.
He's an energetic guy. He will, well, he's already gone down in history, but he, you know, he will rebound. Lots of presidents have bad moments. This was a bad moment. But I think the burden's on the opposition, frankly. You know, if the election were held today, it would be a drubbing for the Democrats. But the election is not today. And there are so many things that have to align for the Republicans in order to do really well. I think they'll do fine in November, but in order for them to do really well, they're at the mercy of the economy. Mm. Will the economy be as bad in September, October as it is today? Arguably, no. And secondly, as I mentioned earlier, can they really go back to the American people and say, bring us back for two reasons? Number one, we screwed up for 8 to 14 years, but we'll do it better this time. And number two, we have no plan, but we know how to say no.
Well, I was wondering if they have a problem with leadership, because they're already talking about Scott Brown for president, and we don't even know who Scott Brown is. He hasn't started, and people in Massachusetts do, but he hasn't had a national stage yet.
We're getting, did you hear that?
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
I don't know what it is. Okay. Yeah, I think that there is. And, of course, shame to say that we were the first ones to come out of the chute with a Scott Brown versus Barack Obama poll.
Oh, for heaven's sake, John.
it was 49-47, Obama over Brown.
Oh,
my
gosh.
I think that was a measure, though, of just where Obama stands against, you know, a hot name. He beat every other Republican, you know, by double digits.
Mm-hmm.
Some, in some cases, going over 50.
Dave, Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen, and your guest.
Hi.
I have a question. What effect do you see the U.S. Supreme Court decision on free speech and corporate contributions of a week or so ago having on elections in our future?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because this is the first time I'm getting to air some of these thoughts. The real enemy out there is a huge amount of public cynicism. Remember, the expectations were very high in the election of Barack Obama in 2008. Somebody who would do things differently. And you know, needless to say, high expectations get dashed. But to bring a system back to a system that was abhorred by the American people, the barrages of negative advertising, the huge amounts of soft money, the sense that there are corporate contributors who can do as much as they want, anytime they want, to say whatever they want for or against a candidate, only, I think, plays into that public cynicism. Now, the issue then becomes, do we reach critical mass where there is a rejection of this kind of system? We'll see. What if voter turnouts are very, very low? in November. Who will be to blame for that? Will it be Barack Obama, who raised expectations too high, or will it be getting back to the system of unlimited special interest spending? And if the latter is true, if it's blamed on that, then I think what you'll see is an uproar for reform,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a constitutional amendment or something along those lines.
And what did you think, John, of his calling out the Supreme Court on that decision and Alito's response?
It was from central casting in both instances. It was a way for the president to ride, frankly, a very popular opinion. Remember, this was also a 5-4 decision. And the fact that someone from the Supreme Court bit back by saying that's simply not true kind of sets the stage for the president now to, you know, to use this as a whipping boy during the campaign. Now it's going to be interesting to see how will the Republicans carry it. So far, they're saying, hey, we're the, you know, this is free speech, but do they want to be portrayed as the party of special interest? And frankly, how are the Democrats going to respond?
Yeah. Thanks, Daryl, for your call. Jim from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I'd like to come at this from a little different angle. Now, this last weekend, I took a course on boundaries, when to say yes and how to say no to take control of your house, of your life, which was put on by the Church Communication Network at CCN-TV on the net. And they gave a structure that I think you can apply to people, and I think you can also apply to institutions as well, and I just thought I'd quickly share it with you. In looking at a situation where a person or a system is deficient, are people able to deal with the problem? For example, if they have no health insurance, they've lost their job, or the employer didn't provide it, are they able? Do I, as an individual, have the resources, the money, and the energy to deal with the problem? And if the person or institution is irresponsible, is this a pattern over a period of time? And then it's a character deficiency, and we don't rescue the person from this. And then there's a four-step process that you deal, and we as the voters can do this in dealing with the institution and the politicians, or we can deal with this in individuals if it's a family problem. First, that you say you care about the person. Second, you say, this is the truth as I see it. And third, you're free not to change. And fourth, the reality is I can't stop you from not changing, but if you don't change, here are is the line that I'm going to draw in the sand. These are the consequences that I'm going to give you for not following through and changing the system. So this might be a structure that people can use in approaching insurance companies and also the government officials and the congressmen and senators if they don't implement change.
I really like that. And in fact, mail, M-A-I-L, at zogby.com. Would you remind me that you talked about this on the show, and send that to me because I'd like to circulate that around to our people. Let me respond to that, though. Number one, people are empowered today as never before. We saw that in the recent election. We saw that you know, huge amounts of money can be raised and raised you know, via the internet in small amounts. There is the possibility then to neutralize, you know, large special interest giving. Secondly, as far as institutions are concerned, remember this name, Ivan, spelled like Ivan Illich, I-L-L-I-C-H, who wrote many years ago about the watersheds of institutions. You know, an institution is formed to solve a public problem. It reaches its first watershed when it expends as much energy and resource sustaining itself as it does on providing the public service, hits a plateau and then a second watershed where it's expending more resources on sustaining itself than the public service. I think we're in a period that I would coin a third watershed where clearly the efforts at sustaining itself run counter to providing public service. I think without even being able to articulate this, this is what people feel. And yet they have available to them an internet. They have available to them social networking, viral media. They have capacities that they never had before that can really change these things. And I think we're in a period of discovery right now. I think people are feeling their oats from the 2008 election, maybe feeling their oats from this Massachusetts victory on the other side. I think people are feeling their oats via the Tea Party movement, which has many of these elements, though it's coming, you know, from a conservative angle. But whatever it is, there is a possibility now for the public to respond and to change. And that's the creative part of the creative destruction that we're in. That trails a little bit behind the just simple destruction.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's coming off clearly.
Yeah, it is. So the address was mail@zogby.com?
Yes.
Okay. Send it along to him. I'm sure Jim will. Here's an email from the president's speech. It was clear that a number of bills have passed in the House, six, I believe, that are waiting action in the Senate. Isn't a large part of the problem the Senate? The Democrats seem weak and ineffective. What's the problem? Leadership? Lack of creative thinking? What can be done?
The Democrats are going through the same process the Republicans are going through. There are the practical Democrats who are ready to compromise, and there are the values Democrats who are saying, we want all or most, and if we don't get either of those, then we want nothing. And that's the difficulty, is riding that bucking bronco and turning that into a majority. It's one thing to have party battles in a vacuum. It's another thing to have party battles in a situation where the entire opposition is opposed, so you need every single vote that you can get to win or to have some sort of legitimacy.
John Zogby is our guest, pollster, president, and CEO of Zogby International, author of The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, and a frequent columnist on Huffington Post. He is also a person who writes for you name the publication, and the publication looks at politics and what's going on in the world, the New York Times, the Washington Post, a number of other publications. He is on top of what's going on and what is going on, what we think is important in this country. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we will be looking at President Obama's proposed changes to the No Child Left Behind Act. So that's tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Second hour of the program, is it true that Fox News is the most trusted network among the general public, CNN being second? We'll talk about that. Hour number two. John Zogby is with us this hour for all things political. Rich from Toma is our next caller. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I was listening to the program, and I'll tell you, the lady that spoke just a few callers earlier, I think, nailed this thing on the head. The American public is angry because we're spending, making money. There's all kinds of backbiting coming out of Washington, and I consider myself an independent, but, you know, like a lot of Americans, I wanted Obama to succeed because we got that hope. But, you know, now, I don't think we'll ever see him get elected. And John had said, you know, it's very early and America may forget for the next presidential election. But I don't think we will. I think there's too much stuff that's happened and continues to happen because, you know, he says one thing and he does the other. And Americans aren't stupid. I mean, we can see it in our children. We can see it in our president. And we're not going to forget.
What is upsetting to you, Rich?
What is it what?
What is it that is upsetting? What has he said and then done something different? What's the basis of your concern?
Oh, my God, you name it. I have not seen him carry out any of the promises that he made. He has continually said something one day and done the exact opposite the other day. And it may not be him entirely. The people mm-hmm. that are around him, they just seem like they're real snaky people. And I didn't like any of the alternatives during the last election, but
Rich, can he get it back?
I wanted something.
I'm sorry, John, what'd you say?
Yeah, Rich, can he get it back? Is there something he can do What about the State of the Union, the meeting with the Republican congressman in Baltimore? Are those beginnings, or are you
I don't believe he'll ever win back the trust of America.
Really?
I believe what he's done has turned anybody that had any hope that he could carry out what he had promised early on. I don't believe he could ever get that back. He certainly lost me.
So what's the ideal scenario for you in November? We have an election. What would you like to see happen?
Well, you know, I find myself drawing more and more towards the Tea Parties. And that was another comment that you made that I kind of disagree with. You say these Tea Parties are come from a conservative angle. I don't believe so. I think they come from an honest American angle. I believe they want to see us do the right thing for Americans, the right thing by Americans. And instead of trying to give all these handouts to people that are sneaking across the borders and people that don't want to do the right thing, let's get back on track with what America's all about and stop the give a freebie to everybody and give everybody a free pass. We need to get back to American values.
John, you've done polling, I would imagine, on the Tea Party. We did a show last week on the Tea Party, and it seems to be in some disarray at this point. Do you see this as a movement that will come up with a philosophy and a group of people who are in agreement about things? There's a lot of infighting going on and people pulling out of their major convention. Can you spend some time talking about that?
Yeah, we've done quite a bit. In fact, we have a piece coming out in the Huffington Post in a couple of days about what we found. But to preview it, I mean, basically, it's split ideologically. Those who support the Tea Party tend to be conservative. Those who oppose it tend to be liberal. There's very, very little in between. There are only single digits of those who have no opinion one way or the other. When you look at the Tea Party, though, and what it represents, it's almost like a primary, secondary, tertiary. The primary, the leadership, the most active of the Tea Party people are, in fact, ideologues. They are libertarian. They're many Ron Paul supporters. They are people who have supported Pat Buchanan in many instances. They are the right wing, but classically libertarian right wing.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary portion of the Tea Party people, I think, are people who identify as conservatives more than moderates, but you know have not been terribly active in the past. The tertiary group, and I think that this is what our caller is talking about here, though, are people genuinely who are disgusted and are not inclined towards a MoveOn.org or not inclined even towards anything else except I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And they are scared about spending. They're scared about their lives going to hell in a handbasket. They are people who fear what we call status anxiety. Hey, the difference between me and the middle class today and me in poverty tomorrow is one new tax, one lost paycheck, one catastrophic health catastrophe.
Yes.
And in one sense, it is eclectic, but it does clearly represent a right-wing ideology.
Mm-hmm. Could we spend a few moments talking about Afghanistan? It's been off the headlines for a little while now, and yet we've committed many more troops to Afghanistan. Are we in support of our mission there? Do we have a clearly defined mission there? What do we think about it?
Boy, talk about a bad hand of cards. This is all over the place. On one hand, it's not viewed as having been worth the loss of American lives. You know, Americans, like everybody else, I suppose, want their wars to be won and want them to be over. And so this is dragged on. On the other hand, there is not a sense for pulling out. We've seen this, incidentally, before. We've seen it with Iraq, and we saw it in the polling, you know, on Vietnam, which is it's now a war in search of a new mission, and the new mission is humiliation. The new mission is not necessarily related to the old mission. There are a growing number of people that don't link victory or loss to Al-Qaeda whatsoever. I mean, after all, where is Al-Qaeda? Well, Al-Qaeda is in Wisconsin. Al-Qaeda is in Somalia. Al-Qaeda is in Southeast Asia. God knows where it is. And winning a war on the ground doesn't necessarily win against Al-Qaeda. So, in short, the president probably certainly had no other choice but to expand troops and go down the path he's gone. On the other hand, a sense that this can't be won militarily and a confusion over what the mission is.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Rich. We go to Travis from Eagle River. Hi, Travis.
Hey. You know, I have never listened to public radio until recently, and I got to admit it is entertaining. And when I hear an Ivan Illich reference, I'm sorry, my mind thinks of Leo Tolstoy. So I was a literature major. But anyway, I did want to make one comment before I get to my question. I still think Scott Brown is not going to be the Republican nominee. I still think they're going to go to Bobby Jindal out of Louisiana when this is all said and done. They're going to need Young to have any chance. So I suspect that would be my prediction. But I have a question, and I'm a simple person at times, and I guess maybe my question is this. If both parties claim they want to do something about health care, and if I heard you right, you said that it does appear that both parties claim to want to do something, why can't they just expand Medicare and say, fine, if you don't have health care, you're covered by Medicare, period?
I'm not the right person to ask because, number one, the polls say that the American people are fine with that, and number two, I'm fine with that. Frankly, I have to wonder if the solution is just too easy. So
that was my question, because it just seems like simply saying, okay, you know, for me, I'm on Badger Care in Wisconsin, so clearly, we had health insurance through my wife's employer for 10 years. She lost her job. Badger Care picked us up. We both have very severe pre-existing conditions. Our options were limited. And, you know, buying health care when you have pre-existing conditions and three children on an income of $30,000 just doesn't happen. And, you know, I tend to be Republican. Even I can figure that part out. And so I looked at the situation and go, fine, we have Medicare. If you don't have insurance, you're on Medicare. And if you can afford to pay premiums for it, which is what Badger Care does, we have a small premium based on our income. And I fail to see why the federal government can't come up with a solution that makes sense. But at the end of the day, I think it's because there's so much childish behavior. I saw a lot of finger-pointing in the president's speech at times, and that bothered me. But I see it from the other side, too. And I'm sorry, but Congress at times looks to me like a bunch of grown men standing around like they're in school going, I know you are, but what am I? And I can only take so much of that, and that's probably why I voted third party last time. It's the first time I've ever done it.
Medicare works. It is demographically challenged, and there are elements of corruption and mismanagement. But bottom line is that it does work. But any time the discussion of expanding Medicare is raised, then you hear the death panels, government-run death panels. Then you hear socialism. Frankly, with the exception of the death panels, you hear all the arguments that you heard in the early 60s against Medicare, for that matter, in the early to mid-30s against Social Security. And these are two programs that passed, and clearly, despite challenges and the need to be tweaked occasionally, work, and I don't understand.
Thanks, Travis, for your call. We have about a minute and a half left. Margie from Franklin, hi.
Hi. I just want to quickly say that if we don't support Obama as he's trying to get back on track, what comes next? And whenever there is, you know, if you watch a basketball game and you put the new star on the court, it might take in the first quarter to get the feel of the floor and the other team, but there's three more quarters. And how many times is the game won in the last quarter? Now, I'm not saying we need to wait three more years for change, but for God's sake, everybody says he's new to Washington, and I don't think Washington plays fair. I think he's trying to get his footing.
It's a very, very difficult job getting your footing. But basically, I'll go back to what I said earlier, which is I think he started with the right message, State of the Union. I think that his willingness to go into the belly of the beast last week to meet with the Republicans in Congress in Baltimore was a stroke of brilliance. Now the team change has to come in. He's got to genuinely show that he has an administration that doesn't want to bully, that really wants to listen to the other side. Not that the other side indicated that it ever really wanted to listen or be heard. I think, though, that the burden is on the president to show that he's the game changer. And frankly, I still think he's the most talented out there. And so I'm not willing to concede that you're going to see a Republican revolution in November.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. John, thank you so much. You're a great guest. Thanks for being with us.
Always good to talk to you, Kathleen. Thanks.
Thanks. John Zogby, pollster, president, CEO of Zogby International, author most recently of The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this great hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. Tomorrow at this time, Obama's proposed changes to the No Child Left Behind Act.